You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
All right. Hello, listeners of CITR. My name is Randy, and you all probably recognize my voice because I love being on the air. I am once again on air for my new project, which is Legal Chat. So if you're listening to the episode a couple weeks ago with Sarah, I did call it, I forget what I called it. I didn't write the incorrect name. Anyways, I just want to let everyone know this is the correct name. I renamed this show like 5 times, but we all know that's the beauty of a radio project is you just keep changing things until you like it. But I'm so excited for this series. So this is a limited series that I'm doing as part of a practicum that I'm doing for the Center for Feminist Legal Studies, in which I will be interviewing 3 different law professors from Allard Law School and that are affiliated with the center. So for this episode, I'm once again joined by a fabulous guest. So today I am joined by Professor Carol Liao. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm super happy that you put up with all of my rescheduling and complicated scheduling, because I tell you, these last 4 weeks before I graduate have been a new experience to me.
This is exciting that it's your last month, right?
Yeah, it's definitely exciting. I wish there was a bit more sunshine to mark the occasion, but unfortunately I have lived in Vancouver for 5 years and I'm used to it, right. So I can't complain too much. So to get the show started, can I just ask you to introduce yourself to the listeners today?
Sure. So I am an associate professor and director of the Center for Business Law at Allard Law. I'm also a distinguished scholar at the Dillon Center for Business Ethics at the Sauder School of Business, so I have to do a shout out there. And I also co-lead the Canada Climate Law Initiative. And my research focuses on corporate law and sustainability, climate governance, and gender and racial justice. And I don't know what else you want me to talk about, but I'm in your hands, Randy, whatever you like.
Well, thank you for trusting me. I appreciate it. No, that's awesome. Yeah. And when I was reading your, I guess, accolades, is that what you call them? Your affiliations?
Well, I don't know. Are those accolades? I don't know. It's roles.
Achievements? Roles. Yeah, there was several of them. And I want to get more. We'll get to this more in the question, but kind of this intersection that you have between business and law, I think, is interesting. As someone who is debating law school, we talked about this before the interview. It goes back and forth since I've been in grade 9, probably, or before. I don't even know anymore. I'm always interested in hearing about how people ended up as law professors, lawyers, or just in the field of law. So can you walk me through how you became, I believe you're associate professor at the law school? Yeah.
How I became an associate professor, I became a lawyer?
I want associate professor. So like how, walk me through your journey, your path to where you are now.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, any details that you feel comfortable sharing.
Sure. I'm an open book. I'm happy to share. to be honest, my path to law school was pretty straightforward. I think before I even knew what a lawyer was, I think I wanted to be one, only because of the messaging from my immigrant parents. Where when I, you know, they'd be like, oh, you debate a lot. And I'd be like, well, yeah, I'm going to be a lawyer, you know, and you just even remember the reaction was like, oh, from parents. And I think, to be honest, it sort of informed to me that it was a type of profession that might have meant something to, you know, this next generation, the older generation. And I had heard a comedian, Ronnie Chang, he has this great line where he talks about how immigrant families, they come and then they're like trying to push their children to be lawyers and doctors. And it's about flipping the clan narrative within one generation. It's like we're at the bottom and now we're at the top.
Yeah.
And so I think just early on, that was sort of something that I thought would make sense. And you know, so fast forward and did the typical what's pre-law, like, you know, political studies, economics,
political science,
whatever.
Yeah.
And got to hear. And then I practiced in New York.
Wow.
Yes, for several years. And okay. That was exhausting and exhilarating, I guess.
I've watched Hallmark movies, I know.
Yeah, it was a lot of late nights and doing, I did mergers and acquisitions.
Okay.
And following that, there was one point when I kind of realized that this job wasn't really sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the hours were just, I saw 4 a.m. a lot.
Yeah.
I had toiletries in my office, right? Like,
oh,
you'd be... Oh, I could tell you a lot of stories that were quite incredible at that time. It was like a very busy time in M&A in the years that I practiced. And I quit when I was 3 months pregnant. And it was just because I couldn't continue with those kind of hours. I was just, you know, the first time when you're a mom, you're sort of like, my fetus, you know, I need sleep. Come your third time, you're like, whatever. You're like, fine. So I found myself, the joke is, I found myself barefoot and pregnant, like putting a roast in the oven going, what's happened with my life? I did so well in law school and here I am. And I think that going in back into academia seemed like maybe a sort of, at that time, a balance.
Mm-hmm.
From what I wanted out of life. And, you know, it was exciting practicing in New York and doing those sort of things. But there was a bit of an absence in the purpose of it, because it just sort of felt like you were bouncing from one transaction to another. And
right.
And while you were getting a very good skill set and doing that, you know, like there was just a point where you're sort of saying, what's this for? Like, other than just to work me to the bone and, you know, like get a nice flush of cash in my bank account. And so I went back to academia. The path to academia is a completely different ball game.
Right.
You realize that the currency is completely different. In practice, it's really about billable hours, the business you couldn't bring in if it's the point where you want to make partner and all that. In academia, it's about what you publish and your research.
Mm-hmm.
And so and it was kind of something that I'd always sort of wanted to do, but was too risk averse to do that leap. And it is a kind of a risky thing to do,
yeah.
to be honest, because there's a huge opportunity cost in leaving practice. Leaving practice is like a ball rolling down a hill. It's not as though you can just jump back in and you're all
right
where you're at. Like, you lose a lot of the momentum that you had. And so there was a point when I did school while raising one, then two, then three children.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of wondering, what may come of that. I don't know how much you want me to get into the weeds, but there was a point where I realized actually getting a PhD in the school that you wanted to be a professor in was a really bad idea.
Really?
Oh, they do not like hiring their own. It is considered incest. Yeah, like it's like just, you know, kind of reproducing the same thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I realized that kind of in the middle of my PhD that I'd played the chess game all wrong.
Mm.
But I'd moved back to be near my family, and my husband and I decided to do that. And so actually, that was when I split my degree with U of T and UBC.
Okay.
And so I, for 1 year, had to be a resident there and ended up just flying there once a week.
Oh, my goodness.
There. It was not very carbon friendly, I have to say. And also just very hard on, you know, the body, because I'd be taking flights at 11 p.m. and then arriving there at 5 a.m. and then doing the whole day there and then, you know, trying to fly back and manage my family life.
Mm-hmm.
And then I landed a job at UVic.
Okay.
And that was great. But the part that I don't mention to people is that I actually also commuted there for 2 years when I was a professor.
Wow. Yeah. That'd be hard. I think people imagine that it's so much closer than it is. And it's really, it's an entirely different place.
I would drive to the airport, park my car, take an Air Canada flight there, and rent a car on the other end.
Yeah.
And teach all day and then come back.
Wow.
And I had calculated different options. There's the ferry, there's the helijet, you know, like there's the Harbor Air.
Mm-hmm.
There's many, many things, and that landed to be the most efficient thing.
Yeah.
And so I did that, and then there was an opening at UBC, and hopefully I was like, okay, hopefully the UBC stink is off me now. I have the U of T experience. I have the UVic, and I had published a ton.
Yeah.
Hopefully they see the value in what I do. Mm-hmm. And luckily I landed that position. Now, you said you wanted the associate professor thing as a whole. Getting separate. Tenure is a lovely thing. And there's just a path to doing that. And
yeah. So is it, because assistant is below associate, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So pre-tenure.
Okay. Oh, and then associate would be tenure.
Yeah. And then after that is full.
Wow.
Oh.
Fancy. Yeah. Is that the next step?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. No, I don't know if I want to get too technical into that.
Don't.
Maybe I'll email you in a few years if that's my path.
No, you should. Academia is a whole different career track. You almost leave one to go to the other. It's a challenge. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't recommend it. You have to be able to be willing to move
all over, yeah.
I think so. And that's why there's some problems in it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and you have to make a lot of sacrifices. Sacrifices that I don't know if I would make in hindsight. Like,
right.
Looking at that, how I flew to Toronto for a year, how I commuted to UVic for 2 years. And that was just because I was like, geographically, I wasn't willing to move.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. You know, mm-hmm. My husband's also a lawyer. We met in law school, which is so nerdy.
And, that is so nerdy.
Yeah, I know. And he's an entertainment lawyer here in the Hollywood North, and he has his practice, too.
Oh, wow.
And my family's here. My parents are, mm-hmm. you know, like it was just for me something. So I was like, what do I do to make what I want for my career also not compromise what I want in my personal life?
Yeah.
And the solution was just not sleeping and traveling and you know, like, and I'm older now and I don't know if I'd be able to do that. Like, mm-hmm.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I'm young and I wouldn't want to do that. So, thank you for sharing all of that. Like I said, I'm always interested because I think this idea that we all have these perfect paths in life to where we are now, it's so inaccurate. And I basically every time I ask someone this question or every time I talk about my own path, I'm talking to 16-year-old me in high school that was freaking out because they didn't think they were going to get where they wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's okay. You don't have to reach that space by the time you're 25, by the time you're like 30. Like, you'll get where you need to be when you are there. And if you don't like it, it'll change.
Totally. I say this all the time. You know, first of all, the saying that life is short, wrong. Life is long.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of opportunity.
Yeah.
And your definition of success may change.
Yeah.
And so just don't put so much pressure on yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. So now I'm interested in, like, specifically your research. So you mentioned at the top of the episode, and I'll just kind of reiterate. So your areas of research are focused on, like, law, sustainability, climate governance, and then racial and gender justice. So how did you kind of arrive at these research areas?
Well, corporate law was what I practiced.
For sure.
So in that, there was this skill set and knowledge that I have that, you know, you don't want to just toss out the window. In fact, mm-hmm. you want to be able to use it for good purposes. And right now we are in a climate emergency. I mean, the mm-hmm. climate crisis is upon us. I care very much about the planet that I leave for my children.
Mm-hmm.
And even not even from a personal level, like just I want to I want more than what the trajectory of what we're heading towards is looking like.
Yeah.
And so what was the question? My research. What I'm focused on is, you know, corporate law oftentimes has been looked upon as this neutral thing, right? We've got these social justice areas, and then corporate law is this sort of innocent, dry, you know, like no normative.
Nothing exciting happens.
Like just, you know, and that is couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
It is, in a way, a legal fiction that we've created where we've allowed for this separate legal personality, you know, some sort of piece of paper to have rights.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we move forward in this crisis that we're in, what is the accountability? What is the, you know, transparency that is going to be invoked upon these corporations and corporate mm-hmm. behavior? Well, you know, it's a very valid question, I think. And when we talk about the disproportionate impacts that are going to be felt as, you know, like with biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, all these things, and I'm happy to talk about climate till I'm blue in the face because it is, you know,
yeah.
like those disproportionate impacts are going to be felt on on racialized indigenous communities far mm-hmm. more. And that's something that just can't be kind of ignored when we're addressing this very multifaceted, complex problem.
Yeah.
And so I kind of feel like I've found my, I don't want to say purpose, because I've watched the movie Soul, and, you know, like it's not my, but it gives me something to work for.
Yeah.
Right. Which gives me a sense of happiness, I think, in putting efforts towards improving something.
Yeah.
And I think right now, you know, it's quite clear that the science on climate change is crystal clear. The issue
yeah.
isn't about the science. It's
yeah.
about values, culture, ideology. And corporate culture is actually a huge part of that. In fact, corporations played a very monstrous role in terms of this problem that we're facing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like with this platform and position I have, I feel this grand desire to sort of disrupt the dialogue
mm-hmm.
and talk about how we can, you know, transform, you know, this institution that in large part rivals the state in power and influence. And how do we ensure that we have a safe and just, you know, place in which all of us can thrive on this planet? That's all. I don't want to sound too, but it's just something that I think about a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely sounds like more like your research, like it's about like they're all in, not to sound cliche, but they're all intersecting. Like
yes,
they're not these separate totally. Areas of research because, and that's something, I mean, that's my entire degree in gender studies
it.
Is that when you talk about climate change, you can't not talk about gender. You can't
exactly.
not talk about race. You can't not talk about class, because all of these things are so pertinent to the conversation when we talk about it. And yeah, I think that's a super, I really like what you said that, you know, we look at corporate. And I mean, I don't know much about corporate law, but I know in society we look at corporations as these neutral kind of third parties outside of it. But in
mm-hmm.
fact, they're like at the front of the line doing all these
Completely.
Things. And yeah, I always, you know, when people, I mean, this is obviously like individual level, but when people talk about like, you know, recycling and stuff, like all these things are good. But, you know, the perspective of it is that these corporations are the ones who did this, and they can change, like they could do
yep.
things. And so instead of, you know, trying to fight on in Twitter mentions about, you know, should you be recycling this? Let's actually put all of that energy towards them.
That is like heading toward, yeah, like that Twitter stuff. Like that, that's like running towards a burning house with a fly swatter.
Yeah.
I heard someone say that and I
yeah.
thought that was quite compelling.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have you know, we have these, right now, there is a general, I think, collective acknowledgement that something needs to be done.
Yeah.
And we're also understanding now how historically there has been a lot of miscommunication. Like, we've got a lot of data coming out, to all public data too, on fossil fuel companies that have controlled the messaging.
Yeah.
On, you know, the climate crisis and how they, it's like tobacco, you know, like,
yeah,
that, and the reckoning that came from that too.
Yeah.
And so to kind of disregard that corporate element in that is a huge mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes on two ends too. One is in the disparities that then occur, right? Like in society, like the disaggregated data talking about poverty rates, talking about, you know, impacts, et cetera, that come from this problematic corporate behavior, I guess,
yeah,
to summarize. But then it's also, there's one end of it, right, that is very much like almost a telling of it from a victimization sense, which is accurate, like, as in there have been harms done.
Yeah.
But then on the other end, it's on the leadership level. And why then, where's the class, you know, like race, gender, all those aspects too, on the end of who's leading these
mm-hmm.
organizations,
yeah,
and causing that. And so my research thinks about it in both those ends, both
yeah.
in terms of the disparate spreading of power and wealth,
yeah,
but also in terms of control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. So kind of building off this, talking about your research, so based on the limited amount that I read and kind of looking at your different articles, it concerns this kind of relationship between sustainability and corporations and, like you said, corporate law. So I read this op-ed that you wrote for the TAI that discussed the importance for lawyers to be aware of climate change and understanding the ways in which it will impact their clients. So can you expand more on the role that the law and those working within it, as like lawyers, law professors, studying, I don't know, all the other things that people mm-hmm. do within mm-hmm. the law, those who work within it have in our understanding and fight against climate change. So kind of the role that they can take on and that they should, like, you, I think you mentioned sometimes in your research, like, an obligation that lawyers and law professors have to, like, understanding climate change and sustainability.
Yeah, it's kind of about changing the baseline,
mm-hmm.
actually. So with the Canada Climate Law Initiative that I co-lead, the focus is on communicating to corporate boards their fiduciary duties to understand the climate risks and opportunities they're facing in their
right.
company. That they can't ignore it. That right now, legal and regulatory frameworks, like, the laws are changing. Like, they're moving in a particular direction, and risk, the understanding of risk is changing too. So you need to start thinking about your impacts of your corporate behavior on the environment.
Yeah.
Like, it's just kind of, and I can go into the granular as to why, but that it comes down, but there's going to be disclosure obligations to be able to do that. The federal government has endorsed the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. The bank regulator has also endorsed it. What that means is that companies that don't know what their carbon emissions are, what their scope 1, scope 2, or scope, potentially scope 3 emissions are, and they don't know what that means, they will need to soon.
Yeah, okay.
And that's a good thing, because I feel like there's this information asymmetry right now on, you know, like, we know certain things aren't good for the environment and other things aren't, but we don't really know carbon emitting factors, right? Like, we don't understand maybe, like, how much is happening along the global supply chains. And so, you know, that op-ed that I wrote in the TAI, it's because actually there's a wonderful group of lawyers right now that are putting together. Last year, we had put a motion to the Law Society of BC that, in my mind, is pretty benign in the whole grand
right.
scheme of our climate problem. But it was a climate resolution. having lawyers recognize that the obligations that they have and that they need to understand what the climate impacts are to better inform their clients. And mm-hmm. it's kind of in a way a call to action, again, saying that, yeah, this isn't a neutral thing. And lawyers actually do have a scary role in helping determine how we move forward in this climate emergency. Because lawyers, whether we like it or not, we're actually oftentimes the gatekeepers to access in the law. Mm-hmm. We play a large role in interpreting the law and applying the law yeah. and all these things. And so in that, too, we do need to consider our fiduciary obligation. We always should be to our clients. Now, fiduciary obligations means, you know, like we are to look at the interests of that that beneficiary, you know, that principal, right? Like we're the agent and we're acting on behalf of that client, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to then, and climate is impacting everything. And we need to inform our client of those risks. So, and also in this truth and reconciliation era, if we really mean what we say, we also need to understand that climate has had a heavy disproportionate impact on Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. And so when we are instructing our clients on, you know, what to do, and many times it may be our corporate clients, we need to inform them of the, you know, latest in climate science and how that's impacting them and their risks and the opportunities there. And that's just something that we think is a very light thing that lawyers should do.
Yeah.
Now, last year when we put that motion forward, and it wasn't me, I'm actually not called to the bar in BC, I'm only called to the bar in New York, but I was in support of it. The interesting thing is that that motion got put forward, and then a lawyer in Quebec actually noticed it and thought it was a good idea and put it up as well to the Quebec mm-hmm. Bar Association. Okay. And Law Society, sorry. And it passed in Quebec. So 70%+.
Mm.
It failed here in BC.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like 42% to 58% or something like that.
And that, so is that lawyers? Like people that took the bar, they all vote on it?
No. A tiny percentage.
So it's like a portion of that.
They're allowed to vote on it. Yeah, but a very small percent.
So everyone has the opportunity to vote, but only a small portion.
That's right.
Exercise that right.
Yes, very small.
Oh.
And it's actually advanced voting that is where all the votes kind of go in, and the AGM is kind of irrelevant. It's tiny.
Okay.
So we're going to put forward a motion again, but I wrote that op-ed kind of during the advanced voting period, and now we've got more of a runway this year to sort of put it out.
All right.
But it's just to kind of be a reminder
of
where we're at right now, right? Because mm-hmm. it's concerning. It is concerning, right?
Yeah, no, I definitely think it's important. And like you said, like sometimes we view these things as sort of like performative or like just like a, you know, it's just emotion or like a lot of things the Canadian government does, right? Like it, you know, you said this thing, but where are your actions? But I think part of, you know, encouraging those actions is making them say the words, because it's kind of like a recognition that like, oh, I need to do this. Like, this is my goal. You know, this is what I'm like striving towards. But yeah, we'll definitely touch more on like this performative kind of thing later on. But we are going to take a very quick break right now. So listeners, make sure you stay tuned in so you catch the rest of this interview.
The milk is sour. I've barely been to college and I've been doubtful of all that I've dreamed of, the brink of my existence.
Second show added. MRG Live presents Haley Hendricks at the Biltmore Cabaret on April 19th. Haley Hendricks is a rising star in the indie folk scene. Her unique voice and intricate guitar playing will leave you spellbound. Don't miss the chance to see Haley Hendricks perform live at the Biltmore Cabaret. Tickets available at admitone.com.
Do you love to read, but your friends and family are tired of you droning on and on about your latest book? Well, forget them, because you have me now. Hi, I'm Randy from Dog-Eared Radio Book Club, a book club coming to you through the airwaves from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. every 2 weeks on Tuesday evenings on CITR 101.9 FM. Tune in to hear the rambling thoughts of a fellow reader that are factually supported by my co-host of the week. Follow the show on Instagram at Dog-Eared Radio Book Club to find out about our next read.
Students of UBC, join us. Join the SSN, a collaboration between the C4 Choral Composition Club and the Music Production Club. With us, you can find someone with whom to collaborate, someone with whom to make music. All skill levels welcome. SSN at gmail.com. Reach out. Together, we can make music. Join us.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
All right. Hello. My name is Randy. You're listening to another episode of Legal Chat. I am joined today by Carol. Hello. And happy to have you on the show. So just before the break, we kind of left off talking about this role that lawyers play within climate change. Well, not within climate change, but within it, like addressing it and like this, you know, obligation they have to their clients. I want to shift the focus kind of away from that. And I want to ask you about EDI departments. So for listeners, that's equity, diversity, and inclusion. There's also like several other names that I think people took to them, but that's personally the one I'm familiar with. So I'm about to graduate actually in 2 weeks, in fact, which is very exciting.
That was a month.
I mean, technically, yeah. The ceremony is at the end of May, but I graduate in my heart when I'm done my last exam.
Absolutely. So. Oh, that sounds so exciting.
Yeah. And I'm going to graduate with a degree in gender studies. And so when I'm looking for jobs, which I have started because, you know, I'm curious what's out there, a lot of the jobs that are open to me are either like I would say like consulting jobs, like working with consulting firms or within corporations in EDI departments. But then I kind of came across this kind of like tension because I found an EDI job for the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which I thought was quite an interesting, I don't know, role that that existed, I guess. So in your research and work in gender and race, diversity and corporate world, how do you kind of understand this tension between the harm that these companies commit while simultaneously having, you know, departments like EDI that are supposed to be committed to like equity, diversity, inclusion? And I guess like the end of my question, which might just like, you know, give it all away, is it just PR?
Yeah. I have a lot to say on that. I'll say that there was definitely, greenwashing, social washing is something that is quite prevalent in corporate culture. And for a while, a lot of these, you know, I don't even know if they were departments, like people, HR or something would be placed in, and it'd be very closely aligned with the marketing department. Same with sustainability. And you're like, why is this a marketing thing? Like, why is this so placed in marketing and not in operations or in the CFO's office or, you know, like the, and I think that right now we're at an interesting phase in society. We're coming off of 2020, 2021, you know, in the wake of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and how there was this global racial reckoning that a lot of us thought was potentially quite transformative, right? Yeah. And a lot of those EDI departments grew, yeah. right? Like in that time. Mm-hmm. And a lot of black squares and perform, you know, like, and there was something that I just recently saw, Ubaka Obogu at in Alberta. He's a law prof in Alberta.
Oh, yeah.
Recently tweeted.
I follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, he's lovely. He recently tweeted, you know, you mean the performative era.
Yeah.
Because actually there was recently, I saw an article talking about how a lot of these diversity officers are losing their jobs now.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot of these departments, look, they're important to have.
Yeah.
What's the alternative in that sense?
Yeah.
But the question is, are resources put
behind
that? Are there tools to allow people in those roles to succeed? Do they themselves have any power within the institution? Because, you know, I talk about corporate law, I talk about sustainability, I talk about climate. Really, my study is on power.
Yeah.
You know, it's the and that's why also remember for corporate law, and when we talk about law, it's a colonial construct.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it is a colonial construct that, you know, comes from a very gendered and racist history.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and who we would allow to practice law, to be CEOs,
yeah.
to do these things, were quite exclusionary.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And not too far, not too long ago.
No.
Either.
Yeah.
And so then when we go into these institutions that have this, you know, history, how do we disrupt the status quo to allow for true EDI?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When the whole construct of it is kind of coming from that,
mm-hmm.
right? Like in terms of what interests we protect, who we value, who we listen to, who we regard as worthy of being a colleague or of leading us.
Yeah.
And, you know, to bring this back also to law is also a profession, right? Like there are business aspects to law and legal services that I remind
yeah.
students about that we can't disconnect ourselves from. And so in that, we do need to kind of challenge some of these ways in which we value things and
mm-hmm.
who we amplify. And so when talking about these EDI departments, and I wish you all the success, you know, like I think they are critical and important.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope, though, that the people that go into those roles are provided with all the tools and measures to succeed.
Right.
Because the worst thing that can happen, I think, is for that department to be just a performative,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a place where complaints die, you know, like
yeah.
just a salve to help get people to shut up.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, diversity policies have been in place for a long time and not with that much success.
Right.
When you look, for example, like that's why the inclusion part is important too, because at one point we didn't even have the diversity. Oops, we didn't even. my arms are flailing as I talk and I'm banging this. But we didn't even have the diversity element. Like, I mean, if you look right now, for example, in corporate boards,
mm-hmm.
You know, we had the comply and explain which era regime, which is when the Ontario Securities Commission required that publicly traded companies disclose disclose their gender diversity numbers or explain, you know, like why there wasn't gender parity.
Right.
And so what we saw at that time, we thought, oh, the disclosure is going to shame them into ensuring that there'd be parity in their boards. No. In fact, what we'd see were just like, it was called explain and explain. It's just like, oh, we don't discriminate.
Yeah.
That's our poll, you know, like, and all yeah. around. And so now it's 2015 to 2023, we've gone up about 10%. So we're like around 23%, I think, for women,
mm-hmm.
racialized persons. So not just racialized persons, it's 8%. So you cut yeah. from that also how many are women of color, right?
Yeah.
And then indigenous peoples, it's less than 1%.
Yeah.
And that's for publicly traded companies. And they actually do much better than private companies mm-hmm. that don't have to disclose this information. And what you see, the numbers are terrible.
Yeah.
Like, and also when you go into nonprofits, oh, a lot of those volunteer free labor kind, that's hugely populated by women mm-hmm. and racialized people. But the higher up, the more prominent the nonprofit, yeah. the more powerful it is. The more men.
Also white. They're so
oh, yeah,
white.
Oh, absolutely. Let me tell yeah. And as someone who is also now doing this academic thing, like it's my second career,
mm-hmm.
right? Like in terms of academic leadership, we have 50% white men, 40% white women. It's 8% racialized men. And 2% racialized women and indigenous men. And indigenous women don't even get on the chart.
Yeah.
So we are seeing in academia a lot of improvements for white women. And in in the corporate world, like some
yeah.
for white women. But we are not seeing that same type of improvement for racialized and indigenous men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll say, though, too... I'll take a white ally over a racism denying person of color any day. You know,
yeah.
It's a thinking that I think needs to.
Yeah. It's more like there comes a point where it's a diversity of like thought, which I hate
yes.
saying
no,
that.
No,
it
no.
sounds like
yeah.
so kind of conservative talking point, but it truly nope. is, because if you're yep. not going to follow up, like, you know, your identity by like supporting marginalized communities and by like actually like moving, like you said, like being an ally
yep.
to all of these communities, then you being there is not helping us at all.
Oh, it's almost, it almost can be harmful, because then you're just like meeting their target and,
yeah.
and you're saying everything's great. And then you yeah. are falling into that model minority.
Exactly. Yeah.
Concern. Right. And so yeah, I'm completely with you on that. And, I just find too, I'll say, there's so much power in collective action
mm-hmm.
and solidarity, and there's also disproportionate risks in particular people expressing that solidarity versus others. Like, I mean, there's so many studies that talk about, actually, if you're a white male and you talk about diversity, oh my gosh, the brownie points you get.
Yeah, you're a hero.
And that's why, so I say to my white male friends, like, you should say something, because why not be a white male hero? Like, say something.
Yeah.
It doesn't harm you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard, actually, being someone that speaks out and is one of the first to do so. Like,
mm-hmm.
there is actually a considerable amount of risk. And I've been thinking a lot lately about how what happens is, if you call out racism in an institution, and let's say you happen to be a person of color, I think what they'll quickly do is make sure you're not on anything, but then they'll quickly find somebody to
yeah.
prove they're not racist
yeah.
To replace. And so, to me, there's costs, I think, that are kind of not publicly acknowledged at times, that maybe we need to do a better job of fluffing out and shaming that sort of practice. I don't know. I'm just... talking. But like, what I don't like, though, is when people tend to try and pit equity groups against each other as though we are all trying to fight for the scraps.
Yeah.
Like saying, well, you're ignoring this then. And I'm like, it's not about battling for that little piece of pie.
Yeah.
And allowing then it to be like those in this, you know, sitting in the winner's circle that designed it
yeah.
get to sort of have this level of complacency and get to
yeah.
pick and choose who they, you know, feel sorrier for.
Yeah.
I really do think that there is so much value in recognizing a lot of these the messaging that's come up from a lot of these important social movements, not conflating them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are unique in their writing of historical wrongs,
yeah.
right? They are they're important in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it is about combating ignorance.
Yeah.
But I really reject that. I really reject that oppression Olympics. And instead, I think we should all link arms and continue together, you know, like, and just saying like, you know, like, just that we recognize the colonial and systems that we're in.
Yeah.
And how we combat that together. And that's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really, when you were talking about that, it just, this, so, this, I am chronically on TikTok. I love TikTok. I will admit that. And just this morning, I saw this video, full context, I didn't watch the original video, but I watched the Stitch. Some listeners will know what I'm talking about. But anyways, I'm citing the internet. That's what's happening. But basically, this person that I follow, Mercury Starda, she's the trans handyman of
okay.
TikTok.
Okay.
Amazing page.
Okay.
But she wrote this book, and basically, she says this line that a focus is not an exclusion. And I think that is like something
yeah.
that is exactly what
That's
you're
great.
Saying, that like all of these movements are so like they're the same, but they're different.
Yes.
Like, and we have to, and just because, you know, I always say, like, when we talk about, you know, like, you're involved in this organization, like, you know, I personally have, I've done a lot of research on reproductive justice and like
mm-hmm.
areas around that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of my other friends in my program have, you know, focused on researching clothing and like fast fashion production and like the
yeah.
role it takes and the impact it has. And all of these things are important, and they all work together, because at the end of the day, we're all fighting that big overlord of capitalism
yes.
and colonialism
yeah.
and all of that. And so it does nothing for us to pin it against each other, because, you know, well, you're not talking about this.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, that's so much what corporations will do and what conservatism does, because it's trying to maintain that status quo. So these EDI departments, and I think especially when EDI is linked to HR, because something I learned that I actually didn't know in my naive brain is that HR departments aren't there for you. Most of the time, they're there for the company. And so kind of going back to what you said earlier, like, who is this for? Like, who are EDI departments working for? Is it the employees? Is it the people? Is it the corporation?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that vastly impacts how they're treated.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
So
sometimes TikTok, I get a lot of wisdom off TikTok. I just always make sure to cite it, because I don't need anyone coming after me being like, oh, where'd you read that? TikTok. I watched it on TikTok.
And, you know, to what I say, because these organizations, I have to believe people, you know, you go in with good intentions. Right? Like, you, and what you need to do is not lose that when you enter in, right? And for companies nowadays, this is what I say, you know, there are table stakes that need
mm-hmm.
to be put in place, like codes of conduct, diversity policy. These things are just, to me, like, how do you not have that? Like,
yeah,
that needs
the bare
to be,
minimum.
Yeah. But you also need to ensure, like, from a complete process perspective, whistleblower protections, like ways for, like, speak up channels,
mm-hmm.
like ways to allow for reporting mechanisms to not be, you know, not be that part of the, like, protective of the institution, but really
yeah.
to say we are a better institution
mm-hmm.
if we're accountable, if we're transparent. Who are our stakeholders? It's not because, you know, and this is a part of my research also. It's not, the law does not say that it's best interest of the shareholders. Let's just be crystal clear here.
Yeah.
And there are flaws in how it's made up. Best interest of the corporation isn't that much better, but, you know, because a lot of times that is aligned to shareholder interests. But we are obligated to consider our stakeholders. And really, what is in the best interest of the interests of the corporation is for the directors to determine.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be that. What's our best interest is to, you know, provide community benefit. You can do that. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we can cultivate our investors. They all want social impact. You know, mm-hmm. they want some impact. You know, like, there are all these different mechanisms that are happening right now in the corporate law space, in the environmental and the social and governance space, you know, like, that are potentially levers to allow for, like, beneficial conduct to the community.
Yeah.
And for EDI departments, you can try and transform an organization. There, hopefully there is amplification and power provided to those groups to be able to allow for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, for those wanting to succeed in those kind of roles, keep your tentacles also outside of the organization so mm-hmm. that you're listening and you've got, you know, like, people that are also doing it in other organizations that, and you're, you know, like, keeping your networks
mm-hmm.
open and your mind clear so that it doesn't get polluted by kind of
yeah
messaging or yeah leverage that makes you actually want to kind of concede to whatever it is they want you to do.
Yeah, no, I mean that's great advice, and that's something definitely that I'm learning, because you go through this program and you kind of have this, like, you know, you're in this bubble, right? Like, I've been in the gender studies bubble, we're all kind of on the same page, and then when you go out of that bubble, it's like, whoa, the world is not right here. Well, Canada, not even the world, but Canada isn't there. And so, yeah, it's definitely something to keep in mind. We only have a couple minutes left, but I do want to, yeah, time flies when you're having fun, right?
It does. I'm shocked.
I do want to ask you, this is probably my favorite question. So you write a lot about the next generation of lawyers.
Yeah.
So I think this question is very well suited. So I want to ask you, what's one piece of advice that you give to future lawyers? I'm gonna stick with lawyers, not academia, because you already gave your advice on that.
Yeah,
but
well, I have written on the next generation of lawyers, and it's because I'm seeing something quite unique, coming out of the millennial generation and Generation Z, which is that you know. You guys have all grown up under this climate emergency and a pandemic. And by the way, pandemics are completely linked to climate as well.
Yeah.
Right? Like, as deforestation leaves, you know, animals to migrate out of their natural habitats, and it just increases zoonotic disease, you know, like, risk. So let's just be clear on that. It's all intersectional, right? And with COVID being the inequality virus and how it is mm-hmm. impacted. So there's all these things that I think have led to this next generation being hyper aware of their surrounding circumstances and the future it's kind of laid before them. And the part that concerns me is that we are on a time limit in a lot of ways from our, you know, this climate emergency. Like, we're going to be reaching tipping points, have in many ways already, that get us to the point of no return in many ways. And at that juncture coincides with perhaps what will be too late for these millennials and Gen Z to reach prominent positions of power in our society. So my idea is amplify them now.
Yeah.
Right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I would say is that, well, my advice, well, first, what I generally say to them is, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that this is what you are inheriting. And be determined, I guess. Be a fighter. Don't forget what your purpose is here in terms of contributing, because whatever the constructs are that we've set before you, you know, the system wasn't made for you, so break it.
Yeah.
Be brave and don't be afraid to challenge, because, you know, that's what I think we need going forward.
Yeah. That's awesome. I wish we had more time, but we are out of time. But I enjoyed this conversation immensely. I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your day to come on here and talk to me. And yeah, I appreciate that advice. You might have just convinced me to go to law school.
Oh, that's great. Oh, yeah, we'll have to talk more about that. For sure.
Yeah, we'll have to see. But thank you again, Carol, for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
This has been Legal Chat. Actually, the next episode is tomorrow at 11. So listeners, you don't have to wait too long. I'm going to have Professor Alexandra Flynn, and I'm going to talk a lot about urban planning. So I hope you're all excited, because I am literally so excited. I'm so excited.